I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. President Obama hosted a conference at the White House last week about countering violent extremism, most notably the brutality of ISIS or ISIL, the terrorist group that now controls significant parts of Iraq and Syria. The president has been criticized by some for not calling ISIS Muslim or Islamic. Here's how Obama explained his use of language.
So I want to be very clear about how I see it. Al-Qaeda and ISIL and groups like it are desperate for legitimacy. They try to portray themselves as religious leaders, holy warriors in defense of Islam. That's why ISIL presumes to declare itself the Islamic State. And they propagate the notion that America, and the West generally, is at war with Islam. That's how they recruit. That's how they try to radicalize young people. We must never accept the premise that they put forward, because it is a lie. Nor should we grant these terrorists the religious legitimacy that they seek. They are not religious leaders, they're terrorists. And we are not at war with Islam. We are at war with people who have perverted Islam.
Our guest, Graham Wood, wrote the cover story for the March edition of The Atlantic, What ISIS Really Wants, where he argues that ISIS is a religious group that follows an apocalyptic medieval form of Islam. He's a lecturer in political science at Yale University, contributing editor to The Atlantic and The New Republic, and books editor of Pacific Standard, joins us from the studios of Yale University. Graham Wood, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
So how Islamic do you see the Islamic State or ISIL or ISIS?
Well, there's a couple meanings of Islamic. One that Muslims might use, meaning correct in their interpretation of Islam. And there's another meaning that I think is very important to recognize as well, which is the meaning of drawing on the traditions of Islam, drawing on this long and diverse and contradictory history of Islam. And ISIS is certainly Islamic in the second sense. It means, by which I mean that when they speak, when they justify themselves, the kinds of judgments that they make and the way they present themselves in their propaganda, they look very clearly to Islamic texts and traditions, and they're very serious about their use of these.
Do you see parallels? I was thinking of the KKK and its use of Christian ideology and symbols, or even the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda that calls itself a part of Christianity. Do you see some parallels here?
I do. I think that both of those could be called Christian organizations. I think there are some, though, that have more obsessive interests in Christianity and early Christian doctrine than those two. I would say, for example, the Branch Davidians of David Koresh would be actually a fine example of a group that is schismatic, is just like ISIS is rejected by almost all Muslims. The Branch Davidians were rejected by almost all Christians, and yet they're clearly a Christian organization, and that's the tradition that they reach into when they describe themselves.
Why is it important for us to see ISIS as a religious group?
Well, you know, there was this tendency before to describe them as nihilists, to say that they had no ideology, that they were a bunch of thrill-kill types. And I think that really played into a kind of prejudice against Muslims as barbarians who couldn't think, who didn't have carefully thought through complicated views of the world. And that's simply not the case for ISIS. I think it's important that we understand who they are, because that's also how they market themselves. This is how they justify themselves, and when they find people who they want to radicalize and to join their group, they describe themselves in these terms. So we should have a good handle on those.
Who are they?
They're a group that has arisen out of the occupation of Iraq. The chaos of that has left an enormous vacuum of power and legitimacy. And I think that's one reason why so many people there have reached to this particular, peculiar, eccentric version of Islam. They, in the end, though, they are an Islamic State, exactly as they say. They preach a very particular version of Islam, and they believe that it has to be instantiated in the form of a state that follows the precepts and organization that was laid down in the earliest generations after the Prophet Muhammad in what they call a caliphate.
But it does in part have its some secular roots. For instance, some of the people drawn to ISIS were Ba'athists under Saddam Hussein. I mean, clearly not necessarily religious in their belief system, but obviously attracted to what ISIS or the Islamic State or ISIL offers to them.
Yes, that's right. So first of all, there are huge numbers of mostly Sunni Arabs in Iraq and in Syria who were basically just caught up in the tide of this organization. The ISIS would roll into town and would say, anyone who's with us can be with us. Anyone who's not is dead. That's a very convincing selling point. And
sure.
It, of course, would draw in plenty of people who have no religious convictions whatsoever, religious background, and that includes many Ba'ath Party members. So a whole bunch of Anbari sheikhs who are making accommodations and deals just as they have in the last decade with Americans and others.
But does that mean that the followers are believers, or they're followers because they fear for their lives?
There's a certain amount of indoctrination that is the people who join the Islamic State have to go through a certain amount of maybe you could even call it brainwashing, describing what they have to believe. What's really interesting, though, is the way that the Islamic State markets itself to outsiders. So not the people who have been living in Syria for ages, but to people in France or in the United Kingdom. And these people are attracted, I think, disproportionately as true believers in the ideology that I've described in the piece.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let me get you to respond to what President Obama said in that clip. And this is what he has been saying about, and he calls them ISIL, not the Islamic State. But he's saying we must never accept the premise that the Islamic State represents Islam. It is a lie. This is a terrorist organization and a perversion of Islam. What do you say back to the president?
Well, of course, the Islamic State doesn't represent Islam, since almost all Muslims reject it. Mm-hmm. But the differentiation that he makes between religious leaders and terrorists, I think, is a false one. You can be a religious leader and a terrorist, and that's exactly what this group is. They have clerics within their organization that are obsessively looking over their peculiar version of interpretations of texts in Islam. And they avowedly, they openly say that we are terrorists. We really want to scare the heck out of people by perpetrating violence in the most telegenic and brutal, disgusting ways.
And what is their goal? I mean, if they're an apocalyptic group, is it the end times or the end days?
Yes, straightforwardly. I think that if you look at any of their propaganda, really almost at random, you will find that it is laced with mentions of the apocalypse and of the particular ways that and milestones on the way to that, and the way that they are fulfilling that goal themselves. They want to polarize the world between Islam and the West. They want to, as they say, burn the middle ground to make sure that there's nothing there except for these choices of a crusader West or Islam. And once they've got that kind of polarized apocalyptic battlefield laid down, they'll execute the plan and try to have exactly the battles that they think are foretold.
And yet, largely speaking, their target, their victims are other Muslims. Yes, there have been some Westerners who have been, you know, horribly killed by ISIS or ISIL, but that's not really their target, their main target.
Yes, that's right. And that differentiates them from al-Qaeda. You know, the core group of al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, et cetera, they were fighting against the West, whereas ISIS, in that whole process of burning the middle ground, is really a form of purification. They want to get rid of anyone who has innovated beyond the first centuries of Islam, and that includes pretty much all Shia, includes all Sufis. So we're talking about they're openly announcing the intention and fond desire of killing hundreds of millions of people at the very least.
As you know, your article has generated a lot of attention and a fair amount of criticism as well. One criticism is that you didn't, for instance, interview scholars who had spoken out against al-Baghdadi when he made, I guess, his lone speech, but made a speech about creating the caliphate. And that you didn't interview some of those scholars who did speak out. And the piece largely rests on a lot of the perspective of Bernard Haykel. I don't know if I pronounced his last name correctly or not. And he's a professor at Princeton University. Can you explain your reasoning?
Sure. Well, first of all, the whole last section of the piece is the perspective of a Philadelphia imam who not only opposes ISIS, but opposes ISIS from a theological point of view, and one that is a good representation, I think, of the quietist Salafi movement. So that's to show, that's partially at least to show that not only is ISIS not an inevitable growth out of Islam, it's not even an inevitable growth out of the literalist reading of Islam. But beyond that, the question of speaking to Muslim scholars do not read the fatwas that ISIS puts out. They have much more important uses of their time. And I think to approach them, of course, there are interesting conversations, and I've had them since the articles come out. But it would be very similar to, for example, approaching the Archbishop of Canterbury and asking about the Branch Davidians. These people, they have much more important spiritual questions to ask, and that's what they're spending their time doing. You find a person like Bernard Haykel and his crew of graduate students at Princeton University. These people do read the fatwas of the Islamic State assiduously, and they have a kind of bird's eye view of what's being churned out. It's the idea that you would implicate Islam in general by asking mainstream scholars to comment on this tiny schismatic organization, I think is mistaken.
At the same time, first of all, I would like to know what the Archbishop of Canterbury says about the Branch Davidians or David Koresh. But the reason I ask that is that members of Islam have been criticized for not speaking out against groups like ISIS or like ISIS itself. Many of them have spoken out and are disturbed by the fact that they don't get the kind of attention or press that, for instance, a group like ISIS gets.
Yes, and you know, a reader of my article would not have that impression, since it clearly states that virtually all Muslims reject the Islamic State. And as I say, it has a long section about one particular neighborhood imam who I hasten to add
he's in Philadelphia.
He is on a mosque on West Girard, and you would be blessed to have this guy as a neighbor. And if you read his impressions of ISIS, you can see exactly the theological basis for rejecting them within his own tradition. There are many other bases for rejection of ISIS, and it's quite clear from what I've written that ISIS is rejected by pretty much everyone other than themselves.
We're almost up at a break here. You describe him as being part of this quietist movement.
Yes. So Salafism, first of all, what does that mean? It means that the sources of authority that he recognizes are the Quran, the Hadith, and the very earliest generations after the Prophet Muhammad. After that, pretty much nothing else. So the quietist movement within Salafism is the majority of Salafis. And it says, look, the Prophet Muhammad was very clear that you do not want a chaotic, war-torn environment for Muslims to live in. This is a bad thing. And so they say, We mustn't buy into this ISIS narrative of having to have a war immediately. Instead, we should essentially look after our private lives, make sure we're pious people and good Muslims, and not buy into a war narrative.
Hold on to those thoughts. We're going to take a very short break. That's Graham Wood, his article in The Atlantic, What ISIS Really Wants. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Graham Wood. He's a lecturer in political science at Yale University, joining us from the studios of Yale University, also a contributing editor to The Atlantic and The New Republic, and books editor for Pacific Standard. And we're talking about his cover story in The Atlantic, the March edition of The Atlantic, titled What ISIS Really Wants. And as I said, it has generated a fair amount of attention. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Graham, you interview a number of, they happen to be men, young men, who I guess have allied themselves or feel a connection to ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State. One young man living in Australia named Musa Serantonio. Describe him for us.
Musa Cerantonio is around 30 years old. He is a convert from Catholicism, And he was named by a report from King's College London as one of the two most important disseminators of ISIS information on the web. Much of what they believe is out there, and the ideological enforcement comes through social media. And so he was identified as an important node in that regard. His passport's been confiscated, so he's in Melbourne, where he's a native, and is pretty much a completely believing ideologue of the Islamic State. And he will explain in punctilious, careful detail his version of Islam and why the kinds of atrocious practices of the Islamic State are necessary fulfillments of God's will.
I'm quoting here from you. Sarantonio explained the joy he felt when Baghdadi was declared the caliph on June 29th and the sudden magnetic attraction that Mesopotamia began to exert on him and his friends. Quote, I was in a hotel in the Philippines and I saw the declaration on television, he told me, and I was just amazed. I'm like, why am I stuck here in this bloody room? In the 7th century, there's no hotel room. There is no television. You met some other members of Al-Qaeda, one of them drinking Red Bull. I don't – help me understand these contradictions here. They say they want this apocalyptic medieval form of Islam for the world, and yet they're there watching television and drinking Red Bull.
Yes. They use iPhones. They use BlackBerries just like everybody else. What they want is to return to a 7th century legal environment. So they believe that Sharia, as practiced back in the 7th century, is what needs to be enforced. They actually don't mind at all if modern technology is used in ways that don't violate Sharia. So sure enough, you know, Musa Cerantonio was wearing sneakers. He was not wearing some kind of medieval sandal wear. He's in almost every way, except for his views of Islamic law, he's fully integrated into the modern world.
You say, and I mean, who you didn't interview are people actually on the battlefield doing these horrific, violent acts against people. But you're saying this is not a collection of psychopaths. How do you know that?
Well, because we can listen to what they say. We can listen to the way that they describe their movement, the way they describe their ideology. They could, if they were just a collection of psychopaths, just do crazy stuff and not have any background of justification. Instead, they have this massive factory of scholarship and fatwas. And, you know, most Muslims would not recognize that as scholarship because they don't agree with the way that it's done. But sure enough, they've got a very active section that's devoted to doing nothing but the rational analysis of their action. And you can read exactly what they write in their own propaganda. It's not written by someone who's just a gibbering madman.
Well, and psychopaths can often be very charming and often very smart. They're not psychotic. You know, they're evil.
Yes, and you know, I wouldn't hesitate to call them evil either. What I would refrain from calling them is simply mad. Mm-hmm. They're not people who are completely wanton in their violence. They have limits. I happen to disagree very strongly with the limits that they choose, and so does everyone else. But they've got them, and they think these things through and can explain them to someone like me who disagrees with them about almost everything on Earth.
So what are the – if they engage in beheadings, they burn people alive, they stone people, they have crucified people, they have raped children, they've raped women, they've kept them slaves. What are the outer limits?
You know, some of the things that you've described, they actually deny having done. I think they have done them, but raping children, rape in general, they think is anathema. But they also think that that slavery is permitted and that you can have sex with your female slave and that wouldn't be considered rape. So it's partly a definitional thing. Mm. But they do have some limits that they claim for themselves, whether or not they follow them or not. And rape would be at that limit. But crucifixion, beheading, stoning, slavery. Not only do they say that these are the correct interpretation of Islam, they say that if you disagree with that, then you're denying the inerrancy of the Quran and the what they call the Hajj punishments. And if that's the case, then you are not a Muslim yourself and you must be killed.
That's Graham Wood. We're talking about his cover story for the March edition of The Atlantic, What ISIS Really Wants. And in about 10 minutes or so, we'll be joined by Murtaza Hussein, and he writes for The Intercept for another point of view, both on what Graham Wood has written in The Atlantic and also his view of ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Chris from Devon to join us. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty. I'd like to say I've read a number of studies and heard a number of reports that say that what happens is whether you have a station like Fox News, which actively wants to promote the idea of an association between Islam and terrorism, or even a program like you're holding today where you're just discussing the issue, both have the same effect of reinforcing the idea that there's a link. So it doesn't matter, you know, the minute you're discussing the issue, whether you're advocating for it or against it, you're reinforcing it. And if I may just briefly suggest also, you know, if you were to devote an hour to discussing the issue of Israeli terrorism, two words that are never or very rarely linked, you know, there's a lot of cogent arguments that could be made supporting that the question that the actions that Israel takes are in fact terrorism, and the way Israel.
Well, Chris, let me just jump in here and just say that we have discussed Israel and the Palestinian situation and from as many angles as we possibly could. But let me take your essential point and put it to you, Graham Wood, which is even just by having this discussion, we are subliminally perhaps or maybe more overtly making the connection between terrorism and Islam.
Yes, and I hope that people read my article. I think that connection would be dispelled or at the very least complicated. And, you know, on the point of Israel, I would just point out that if we have, as we actually do, Messianic Jews who are invoking the book of Joshua in the creation of settlements, then I would also call that certainly a Jewish movement, just as I would call the Islamic State an Islamic one. It's rejected by most Jews, nonetheless drawing from Jewish texts and traditions in a particular and eccentric way.
And just to underscore that, we're not seeing beheadings and crucifixions and people being burned alive in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Let me go back to your article, because it also sounds like you're saying is that the seeds of the Islamic State's future are sown within the organization itself, that it will not be able to sustain itself. Did I read that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there is no modern human civilization that enjoys living under the kind of medieval practices that the Islamic State has. And the only reason it continues to exist is because there's Bashar al-Assad on one side, and then there's a predatory Shia government on the other. And the security that the Islamic State provides is something that permits it to survive. But you know, if it were able to, if the people there were able to change it, I think they would.
What I've been reading coming out from reporting of people living under ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State is that they have electricity 1 hour a day. Even the paltry rights and freedoms that they had before have been diminished, and that life is really hard. And some say, well, really, this is a problem of the Middle East, and it's up to the people in the Middle East to, in a sense, rise up against ISIS or ISIL. Do you think that's possible?
I think it's impossible right now. Under the current conditions, it's just simply a guarantee of slaughter, no matter which way you look at it. The fact of the matter is, this is a very difficult, complicated problem, and understanding the religious ideology is a huge part of it. Also, understanding the politics of it is important, and then understanding the very, very deepest root causes, which I would identify with the region's complete lack of governance and legitimate authority over the course of decades. It's very complicated, and I think you can't imagine that how difficult it must be to live there and to throw off this yoke of the Islamic State, given what the alternatives are.
So, how do you see U.S. strategy or policy to deal with ISIS?
ISIS has such a clear vision and narrative of itself as the standard bearers of Islam versus the Crusader West that I think that our main concern should first of all be the arrest of their expansion, making sure that they, instead of being an inexorably expanding state, are a small and pathetic shrinking one, or at least stagnating one. And then we should also make sure that that narrative, Islam versus the West, is one that is consistently disproven by facts on the ground. And that's something you can see already in the fact of Kurds having led the charge against the Islamic State so far in the northern areas, and also Muslims from Baghdad in the south. I think if you had images of American troops trying to invade versus Muslims, that would backfire in a very big way, and I would counsel against that.
What about airstrikes by Americans or U.S. forces?
I think that the airstrikes that are in support of Muslim forces are a necessary aspect of this. Unfortunately, there's no way that airstrikes or even probably proxy war will actually be able to invade the strongholds of ISIS, like Raqqa, for example. So it's going to be a long haul, but I think time is definitely on our side.
And how to counter the propaganda that comes out of ISIS?
Well, the propaganda, as I say, it's attempting to burn the middle ground. It's attempting to make sure that Muslims have to choose between either a corrupt dictatorship or the United States or Islam as represented by the Islamic State. So I think making sure that narrative is hard for the Islamic State to sustain is really important. Unfortunately, we can't really give something as compelling as a good versus evil cosmic showdown, which is the propaganda line of the Islamic State. Mm. So, you know, what we have to do is allow that positive view of the Islamic State as the good versus evil showdown to erode and wear away in its own terms. And with time, it will.
In time, it will, because people living under it will see it for what it truly is?
Yes, they'll find that the caliphate is a terrible place to live. They'll find, as the Islamic State, you know, it claims to be a utopia. It claims that it's going to provide food, housing, shelter, medicine even to its residents. It will never be able to do that. It's a very poor place, and far wealthier countries have failed to do that. So the promises it makes are ones that there's no way it can fulfill, unless it's right and it's somehow the fulfillment of God's will and a miracle saves it. But that, I think, is very unlikely to happen.
Well, Graham Wood, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a lecturer in political science at Yale University. And we've been talking about his cover story in The Atlantic, the March edition of The Atlantic, and it's titled What ISIS Really Wants. Joining us now is Murtaza Hussain. He's a journalist, a political commentator for The Intercept. His work focuses on human rights, on foreign policy and cultural affairs. And Murtaza Hussain, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we've been talking, with Graham Wood about his piece in The Atlantic. What is your response to that?
Well, I read the piece and I wrote a rebuttal to it as well, too. I think that he made some necessary and good points, pointing to the legitimate religious invocations and motivations of many foot soldiers of Islamic State. I think that what myself and many others took issue with was his characterization of the Islam as promulgated by Islamic State as being, as it described in the article, coherent and legitimate, which for anyone versed or with a reasonable familiarity with Islamic traditions, it can be very clearly seen that's not the case.
And just sort of following up on that, and I, as a complete outsider myself, you know, trying to figure out how Islamic is a group that actually calls itself the Islamic State. And for people who are not versed in Islam, but hear quotes coming from the Quran or alleged quotes coming from the Quran, this is a group that sees itself as Islamic. But do you?
Well, the issue is that it's incorrect to say that it has no relation to Islam, and it's a good point to push back on that. But Islam as a tradition, it's based on centuries of jurisprudence and readings and precedent, which Islamic State and other radical groups which have come about over the last century or so completely disregard. So this is why that you see it's very broadly rejected by Muslim scholars, including very conservative scholars like Muslim Brotherhood people or even people like Abu Muhammad Maqdisi, who are considered to be very radical, because the way that they approach these texts and these rulings is completely, it has no precedent. And that's why that while you could say it does have some relation to Islam, it has no relation to Islam as anyone who's versed in Islamic traditions would recognize.
I played a clip from President Obama talking last week about why he essentially doesn't call this an Islamic movement or a part of Islam. From your perspective, is the president sort of tied himself in knots or in a pretzel over this, or is that a legitimate point of view?
I think it's a very wise position, because the whole premise of Islamic State is that they want to be the mantle carriers for Islam. They want to be seen as the force of Islam, and they want to create a zero-sum sort of game where there's the West on one side and them representing Islam on the other side, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of not just Muslim lay people, but scholars reject them. And if the president were to accept this premise, then he gives them exactly what they want, and he gives them, confers upon them a legitimacy they would never otherwise have. So I think that he's taking a very wise rhetorical position, in that he's not adhering to sort of zero-sum clash of civilizations rhetoric, which they're trying to engineer.
And we're almost up in a break here. And one of our callers said earlier, just by talking about ISIS and Islam in the same sentence, that we are promulgating some propaganda ourselves. Do you think that's – I mean, it makes it difficult to talk about, but nonetheless, I'd be curious about your response.
Absolutely. The entire reason they call themselves Islamic State is because they want to be, you know, they want to have that legitimacy, and they want to create a world with this binary black and white between themselves and those whoever opposes them, the West and those Muslims who don't agree with their positions, who they would then characterize as not real Muslims. So, you know, it's a very canny sort of branding and naming that they've given themselves, because it helps bring that about. I think that they create, of course, like, when you call them Islamic State, it sort of feeds into that. That's why maybe call them Daesh, which is a name that they don't like. It's an acronym for Islamic State in Arabic. But it just speaks to what their motivations are. And when you look at their literature, they even specifically say that their last magazine issue was entitled Eliminating the Gray Zone, because they want to eliminate any gray zone between themselves, anyone disagrees with them, and the Western countries.
Hold on to that thought. We have to take a very short break. That's Murtaza Hussein. And we'll take that short break, get back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We began our conversation in this hour talking with Graham Wood about his March edition article in The Atlantic called What ISIS Really Wants. And our guest now is Murtaza Hussein. He's a journalist, a political commentator for The Intercept, and his work focuses on human rights and foreign policy and cultural affairs. Talking with him both about the article and also about ISIS itself. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Murtaza, we have a tweet from Nate. He says, what scripture is ISIS using to justify the level of brutality and barbarism they apply in their beliefs or their actions?
Well, they traditionally use Islamic scriptures. They go back to the original sources, but they innovate their own way of looking at them, where that they can. None of them are mitigated by other readings or other sources which are accepted, which are supposed to prescribe their actions. And when they can't find any justification in Islamic sources, then they just make up their own reasoning. When they took the liberties of burning that Jordanian pilot,
right,
even though the Quran specifically bans burning people in any circumstances, or the Hadith literature does. So then they said. Then they went back and said, well, analogically, we're allowed to do it because X, Y, and Z, which is, you know, they're basically finding whatever justification they want to do whatever they want. And there's a reason that even if there are things which are, you know, in the Quran does prescribe rules for warfare and certain conduct, but they're supposed to be mitigating factors, and they should not be aggressive. But they've sort of melded them or transform them whenever they want to into a license to whatever they want.
But is it making it up, or is it just the most sort of extreme, narrow interpretation of what's in the Quran?
Well, even at the original time when the Quran was promulgated in the 7th century, there were rules to interpretation which were put forth, because for the majority of the Quran, there's parts of it which are contradictory, there's parts of it which are very vague. And as such, they had to create accepted rules as to how to interpret this. The what makes radical like groups like Islamic State radical and other radical groups, you know, which have come across very much in the last century this way, is because they don't abide by any of these rules, and they find the rules to be an innovation in themselves, even though they've always been accepted throughout the original caliphate and through the Abbasid times, mm-hmm. the Ottoman Empire. And they've discarded all these, and they've either, you know, wanted to read things in their own way, or they've created their own rules, which, you know, is effectively an alternate Islam.
Graham Wood interviewed a number of followers of ISIS for his piece in The Atlantic. You described them in your piece as the world's most hyperbolic and media-friendly Islamic extremists. And I talked with Graham Wood about one of them, a man who's actually living in Australia, a Catholic who converted to Islam. Was he snookered? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the thing is, these people, Anjum Chowdhury and Musa Sarantonio, because of the internet, they've been able to, and because of the fact they speak English, they've been able to attain a profile in Western media far greater than their actual popularity, and far, far in, you know, contrast to their level of actual credentials or objective knowledge about these subjects. They are very provocative, and they make very good, you know, they're very good on TV, they're very good for quotes, because they will very gladly fill a certain narrative, but they're not recognized as experts or leaders by any standard of any considerable number of actual Muslim people, and they don't have seem to have any objective knowledge or, you know, education in Islamic text or history. So, I mean, it's not to say that no one should speak to them, but mm-hmm. when they're put forward without any context and without any say from people who actually are accepted or actually do have objective knowledge of these subjects, then it gives them an influence which is far, far greater than they actually possess.
How do you understand, though, the attraction to ISIS or ISIL? I mean, clearly there's an attraction within the region. There are people coming from countries, including a handful from this country, that seem to be attracted to this form of extremism.
I think there are some people who are motivated by genuine religious zeal and what they see as, you know, a potential revival of this ancient institution of the caliphate, even though any mainstream religious authority, or pretty much all of them universally, have said this is not a legitimate form. There are some people who will be find this attractive, especially when it's they have such a great ability to speak to people through social media and through the amplification of the media as well, too. It's still a proportionally small number of people who have traveled, but there are some people, inevitably, that will happen. On the ground in Iraq, it's a bit more complicated because, yeah, there are people who are motivated by religious zeal, but because of what's happened in Iraq in the past 20, 30 years, there are people who are totally deracinated from their, you know, their roots and their culture. There are people who have suffered grave injustices, and they see this as a way of rectifying that and restoring their own dignity, and it's a misguided way, and I think the majority of people still recognize that. But there are enough people who see it as deliverance from their problems that they're willing to sign on to it. And then again, at the leadership level, there are former Ba'athists who see this really as a way to reassert power after they're disenfranchised following the 2003 invasion.
But what about the violence? And I mean, I think, you know, most of the world is just horrified by the decapitations, setting people on fire, as you said, their crucifixions, their slavery. Is it the appeal of the violence, or what is the justification for the violence?
I think this extreme violence, this is part of what they're trying to do when they say eliminating the gray zone. Because, when, for instance, when they burned the Jordanian pilot, there were mass protests and, you know, widespread universal revulsion in Jordan to what happened. What Islamic State is trying to do, they see the world as containing a very small number of true Muslims, which are them and the people who are willing to abide by this. And everyone else, including the people who reject these tactics in their mind, are not really Muslims. And so when they do these things, they're trying to create a polarization or binary to weed out everyone, you know, the 99.9% of people of all backgrounds who would find this abhorrent. Okay, well, now we've clarified these people are the enemies. And the 0.001 who look at this and say it's acceptable or they're attracted to it, these are the people who are really on our side. So this is all about creating this binary and polarizing the real from the not real in their minds.
But within Islam itself, I mean, it seems that that's where the violence and the conflict is, which is Muslims, in a sense, terrorizing other Muslims.
Exactly. And the thing that's quite notable and ironic is even the people who we've looked to as being radicals beforehand have expressed the same sort of revulsion towards this, because it's very exclusively almost focused on Muslims, the violence. Probably the overwhelming majority of people who've been killed by Islamic State and other groups have been Muslims, because they've always viewed Muslims nearby as their primary targets. And Westerners, even though, you know, it gets a lot of play in Western media, they've really been primarily an afterthought. And when Westerners have been attacked, it's been almost as a way of provoking them into invading Muslim countries and generating more grievances, which will make, you know, the radicalism of these groups seem more attractive. So, and, you know, it's not new that they've been condemning this and they've been horrified by it, but the level of violence is just ramping up very, very much so. And, you know, since 9/11, it's been going further and further. You see in Pakistan that massacre of school children. Despite everything that's happened in Pakistan in the last decade, this is something which is totally unprecedented, and it was as horrifying as what Islamic State did. So they're trying to ramp up the violence to create this sort of zero-sum conflict which they're trying to engineer.
That's Murtaza Hussain. He's a journalist, political commentator for The Intercept. And we are talking about ISIS and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We have a comment from Imad in Northeast Philly. He says, what about the al-Nusra Front in Syria? They have the same tools and seem to have the same goals. They are Salafists doing very similar things. Why aren't they mentioned in the same breath? Murtaza, can you answer that?
Yeah. So al-Nusra Front is al-Qaeda's franchise in Syria. The difference is, like, I think they do share many of the same beliefs and the same end goals of imposing Islamic law, even if it's a different type of Islamic law, a similarly conservative and, I would say, uncompromisingly cruel version of Islamic law. The difference is that, and this goes back to even during the Iraq War, they don't seem to practice or endorse this mass indiscriminate violence, especially against lay people of certain other religions. They're more focused on sort of building consensus and through their own fighting prowess, winning people over to their side, and through what they would characterize as good governance and restoring law and order. So they're sort of a less radical version of Islamic State, but their genealogy is very much the same.
Let me get, looks like Scott from New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
As I've been listening to this, you know, I find that very few people that are religious or Islamic really agree with their philosophy, and I wonder if it might be a little bit more of an economic problem as we see all these groups emerging around the world in Pakistan and Africa and the Middle East. You know, these are places with failed economies where you have massive unemployment, you know, and if you're a 20, 25-year-old man and you can't find a job and you can't move out of your house, you can't start a relationship, what do you have left to lose? Islam or any kind of religion is an easy way to hide behind excuses for lashing out in violence. But I really, you know, it's so inconsistent with religion and much more consistent with desperation from just noticing that, I mean, why would you attack all of your neighbors and just antagonize everybody except for the fact that you have nothing left to lose?
Well, Scott, it's an interesting comment. Let me give Murtaza Hussain a chance to respond. What do you think?
I think it's absolutely true in many cases, especially with people from other Arab countries who are traveling to join Islamic State, because there are huge masses of unemployed young men who are frustrated and they have no real option or no real way to create meaning out of their lives. And suddenly this group arises which promises you glory and promises you meaning and promises you also, like Islamic State, if you look at their own statements and their own practices, they do give economic support to people who join or make pilgrimage to their state, quote unquote. So it does satisfy all those needs. It's a self-destructive way of satisfying them. But if you have no other real prospects or options, it becomes attractive. And that's why you see, you know, many young men, as you mentioned, traveling there in what I think most of us would see would end up being a folly.
So how do you see this ending? I mean, if their goal is to take the world back to the 7th century and to have the world living under their brand of Islam, I mean, clearly that's not going to happen. So how do you see this ending?
Well, I think that they'll have to be militarily defeated. I don't think that the United States should send ground forces in to help accomplish that, at least not in a forward military role. I think that the Iraqi army and the Syrian army will have to invade their territory and eventually dislodge them from it. I'm not sure how capable they are of doing that in the short term. Past experience would suggest that it would be quite difficult for them, and it may come at great cost to the people living under these lands. But certainly, I don't think that this group can be allowed to continue to exist and to continue to hold territory, because it has a pernicious and toxic effect on the region and on the world. And I think it's worth keeping in mind that the reason, part of the reason that they're also doing these public displays of brutality is to goad people into attacking them and to engineering this, you know, massive ground conflict. So that's not to say that it should not happen, but they are preparing for it, and they will make it very difficult.
Let me read an email from Cam saying, I would like to suggest that by calling these terrorists Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL or self-proclaimed Islamic State, you make the continuing connection between Islam and terrorists, including all their subhuman behavior. This just fosters more ill will, bias, whatever, among non-Islamic peoples everywhere. I would go to the next step from the president's suggestion and just call them ISIS terrorists, or just call them terrorists without ever mentioning Islam or Muslim. And, you know, this is sort of what the show is about, Murtaza, but you have to call things what they are. And I think we're still struggling to figure out what they are.
Yeah, I choose to just call them Islamic State, although many people I know will call them Daesh, which I mentioned is the Arabic acronym and something which they find particularly antagonistic. It is sort of perverse, and it's really kind of a brilliant, you know, in a diabolical way, move by them to name themselves this, because they want to create that connection in people's minds, and they want people to keep saying the name and keep, you know, identifying all Muslims with them, even though all, you know, Muslims generally reject them, because it helps engineer this sort of civilizational divide which they're trying to create. So while you're forced to call them what they are, and, you know, as I mentioned, even I myself do it, it does play into their plan, and, you know, it's something which is, if objectively is quite canny on their part.
So what does Daesh mean?
Daesh is Dawla Samia in Iraq and Sham. So basically, it's just basically the Arabic acronym for saying their full name, the Islamic State, in Arabic. Yeah.
But it's considered what, an insult or sort of not taking them seriously?
Yeah, it's like a flippant way of referring to them, which does not accord them the proper respect and grandeur which they would get out of being called Islamic State or Dawla Islamiyah in Arabic. So it's sort of like disrespectful, I'd say. Or they see it that way.
I'm just curious, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, and even going back to this article in The Atlantic, what ISIS really wants, do you see that as helping us understand what's going on in that part of the world?
You know, I don't want to dismiss the entire piece, but I did not find it to be particularly sophisticated, or not sophisticated, but particularly scholarly reading or of it that was, you know, informative to people who have advanced degree of knowledge in Islam or how this group came about. I think that it made a very good point in saying, reminding people that these people are motivated by a genuine religious ideological zeal. But the characterization of Islam and their interpretation of it as being a particularly scholarly version or a learned and informed version, to anyone familiar with how Islam came about and evolved to be what it is today, that claim is very disingenuous, and it does not account for the way that they actually approach Islam or their relation to the Islamic mainstream, which it would see them as anti-scholarly and anti-intellectual, in fact.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, especially at such short notice. Murtaza Hussain, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a journalist, political commentator for The Intercept, and we began our conversation with Graham Wood talking about his cover story in the March edition of The Atlantic titled What ISIS Really Wants. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out what we're all about. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of the show. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.